Accession number 28657, Mr. Jeff King, Real Six. Now, you left Bruntingthorpe in June for some more leave, and then went to 1660 Heavy Conversion Unit at Swinderby.
That's right.
Where is Swinderby? Is that Lincoln?
That's Lincolnshire again, yes. No, not far from Newark.
Now, what were you doing with 1660?
Well, at 1660, it was a heavy conversion unit, where we then went on to the heavy bombers. In the first instant, we were flying Manchesters.
Now, that's an unusual, I mean, aircraft for people to actually have flown, as opposed to know about it.
Yes.
Well, now, tell us a bit about what that was like, that flying a Manchester,
well,
or in and out.
Precisely the same as in the Lancaster, except, of course, the Manchester was the forerunner of the Lancaster and was a twin-engined heavy bomber. Now, this aircraft was taken off ops because it had constant engine problems. And in the course of its history, the Lancaster was developed from the actual Manchester itself. It was slightly modified. The tail unit was slightly modified. And, of course, four engines were fitted instead of the two.
Now, we'll go on to the Lancaster later, but for the Manchester, how did your flights and that go? Because there seems to have been you seem to have had a problem with the power supply.
Yes. On one of my bombing details, the power supply was very weak, and I couldn't do my normal bombing runs, and in the end had to jettison the load that I had. It was an unusual problem, in actual fact, but it just happened that particular aircraft had a very weak power supply.
Now, what about the Lancaster? Tell me more about that, just a basic outline of the Lancaster. What were your first impressions of the Lancaster when you got it?
Well, moving from the Manchester to the Lancaster, we immediately liked the aircraft.
Now, why?
There was something about it. You'd got that additional power, and there was a great stability, for one thing. And our skipper enjoyed it. And basically, we all really took to it immediately.
Now,
everything about it was right, in fact.
Now, you'd also get two extra crew at the same time, which
weren't
necessary on the Wellington.
No,
now, there, Frank Green, the mid-upper gunner. Now, what was he like?
Frank was an Australian. He joined us as a mid-upper gunner.
What rank was he?
He was a warrant officer when he joined us. And
what was he like?
A very droll sort of chap. Very athletic type, and of course he immediately fell in with the crew, and at the same time we picked up our flight engineer.
Now,
Jock.
Now, this is Robert Burns.
Robert Burns,
another warrant officer.
Yeah, well, Robert was a flight sergeant.
Flight sergeant.
When we picked him up, yes.
Of course, people get promoted, yeah.
That's right, yes.
And what was he? You called him Jock, as you discovered. Robert Burns,
Robbie Burns,
distinguished name.
Yes.
Now, what was he like?
Well, he was a typical dour Scotsman. And again, a terrific, cool individual, as was proved later on in our operational flying.
And these two, they fitted well into the existing crew.
They did.
No problem.
No problem at all. No.
And what about now? The other thing is, what was life like at Swinderby? Where were you living?
Living in very cramped conditions there. In bunk beds, of all things, in the officers' mess. But the 8 weeks there just flew by. And in fact, There's one little episode there where we were detailed to go over a commando course. And I went through the thing wearing my best uniform.
Tell me about it. What type of commando course?
It was a typical course, a commando course, going through dirty pipes.
Was it an assault course?
An assault course, yes. How in heaven's name I got through that without damaging my uniform, I do not know to this day. But I managed to come through, go through the lot without...
What was the point of putting a bomb aimer through an assault course?
Well, this was part and parcel of the course. Toughen us up, I suppose.
And anything else you remember about your time at Swinderby? You do seem to do some quite interesting night exercises over the Irish Sea.
Yes.
Tell me about that, because that includes mine laying, which I know is a job the Lancasters did anyway.
Yes, yeah.
Well,
again, basically speaking, we were always doing training flights. Most of these were flights, cross-country flights, which again involved bombing, practice bombing, mining exercises in particular. On this one in particular, the weather was so bad we had to abort. I managed to get the bombing in, but the mining operation we had to cancel and abort. The weather was atrocious.
Just before you leave, you get promoted to flying officer. Did that make any difference, or was that just...
No, that was automatic.
After, so that's based on a period of time.
Time, that's right, yeah.
Now, this is where the whole crew then progress. Now, let's go through to the first operational squadron. Tell us all about it.
Yes, well, once we had completed our training and conversion onto heavy bombers, we were posted to our bomber squadron. And in our own case, it was to number 57 Squadron, East Kirkby. Now, 57 Squadron had originally been stationed at Scampton, and they were posted to East Kirkby when the station opened, which was the time that we arrived, the same time that we arrived there.
And East Kirkby, that's also Lincolnshire, isn't it? Lincolnshire. Most of them are Lincolnshire.
That's right, it was just about 12 miles north of Boston.
Now, before we go on, can you describe the base? What was the base like? The airfield.
Well, the airfield itself was, again, at the foot of the Lincolnshire Wold, as it so happened. One of the landmarks there was a windmill at Old Bolingbroke, which proved to be very useful in the course of our operations. The same as the Boston Stomp. Of course, that was something you could see for miles away, this terrific steeple.
And what about the actual field? What was it, a concrete runway?
Oh, yes, several runways. Different lengths, of course, and in different directions, with the hard standings for the various aircraft all around the drome. It was a wartime construction. Our billets were Nissen huts, which were bloody damp.
Now tell me, what were they like?
Well, ordinary tin sheds, basically, with sufficient beds for two crews.
So all the crews were in together, whatever the rank?
No. Again, you had your officers' quarters. But they were all basically these Nissen huts, sergeants or otherwise.
What was it like in these damp huts?
Well, we had one of these little tortoise stoves in the middle. And they were reasonably efficient. Of course, being commissioned, we also had a batman So he was looking after these places for us.
Now tell me, what did the officer's servant do for Batman do for you? Because we've not mentioned it. What would he do for you?
He would clean our buttons, look after our uniforms, press the trousers, etc. And he had a certain number of men to look after, of course.
And would he tidy the hut?
Oh, yes. We never had to do anything in that respect.
And how did you, I mean, would you tip him, or how did you treat him?
Oh, yes. We treat him very well. And he used to look after us very well, too. In the course of our stay there, he would also advise us if we were flying on ops that particular day. Because sometimes we'd come in from an operation. That could be any time of the night, going into the morning. And if perchance you were on ops the next day, which was highly unlikely, but if that occasion did arise, he would give us a call.
Now, what I want to do now is, before we go, is I think look at a typical raid, and we'll base it on your first raid, which is probably one you remember quite well, on the 23rd, 24th of September 1943 on Mannheim.
That's right.
But we'll use this to hang a description of a typical raid on, as indeed you slightly do in your memoirs.
Yes.
Now, so what would the first thing you knew about a raid be? How would you be informed that you were on a raid?
In most cases, the first indication you would have would be either by your batman telling us that you were on a particular detail. You would then report down to your flight office and to your flight. In our own case, it was a flight. And there you would be notified that you were on ops that night. But you wouldn't know what the target was until you were advised at briefing.
So all you'd get in the first place is you knew you were on a raid.
That's right. You would be told the time of briefing, and at briefing you would be told all the particulars of that particular raid. Here again, as I mentioned earlier, you had a bombing leader, nav leader, and such like, and each of those individuals would be responsible for briefing you.
Now, hang on, I'll come back. First, what was the flight office? Do you remember which flight you were in, actually?
Yes, we were in A flight. There were A and B.
Now, what was the flight office? What would go on? Who was there? What was there?
And you'd have you'd have your flight commander. He would be a wing commander, and he would be in charge of your particular flight and squadron.
And would it just be his office, or would there be a flight room for a crew room?
There would be from that point of view, in the flight there would be a pilot's room. In actual fact, we were never called into a general room within that building. There would be a separate briefing room where the crews, once advised that we were on a raid, we'd be advised of the time of briefing, or our pilot would be, and then we had to assemble at the briefing room.
Now, what would come first, the general briefing or the section leader's briefing?
It was the section leader was basically at the general. It embraced everything at that point.
Now, what was the explain what the general briefing was then?
Well, you would assemble as a crew, and you would then have your nav leader, bomb leader, bombing leader, and they would advise you as to what your bomb load, in my own case, what the bomb load was. I would be given written details of that, whether it consisted of a 4,000-pound HC bomb, incendiaries, which was the normal load we would carry on an industrial target.
Now, hang on, but this wouldn't be at the general briefing.
Oh, yes. There's, well,
because in your memoirs, you make the distinction between the general briefing and the specific briefings by the leaders.
Well, certain of the categories, like the pilot, he would have a separate briefing. The wireless operator would have a separate briefing. But myself and the navigator, we would be in the general briefing.
And that's where you were told of your bomb.
Bombing, that's right. And the target, the map, you would have this massive map on the wall, illuminated, with the route and everything marked on that particular route to the target, to and from the target.
Now, you'd be told, obviously, your type of bomb load. Now, can we talk a bit about what the Lancaster could carry? If you may not remember the exact figures, they're beautifully laid out in your memoir, so I don't want to test you. But
yes,
what sort of bomb load would you be carrying? Now, this would be where you found out what you were. You
know. Yes. On most of the industrial targets that we bombed in 1943, we would be carrying a 4,000-pound bomb. That's a high-capacity blast bomb, together with either 8 or 9 canisters of incendiaries. Now, these canisters contained 90 4-pound incendiary bombs. So you can see there was quite an appreciable load. Loads could vary from target to target, but that was the general load.
So they would tell you the type of bomb load.
Yeah.
Now, they'd also tell you the height you were releasing it from.
That's right. One of the most important factors was time and height. You must appreciate that there were several squadrons making up a raid. Each of us were briefed in at a given height. Now, it was most important to keep to that height, but most of all, the time element. Otherwise, you're going to get mixed up with the other squadrons. So it was imperative that you kept to the time and your height.
It also, there's something called a pre-selector switch. Now, would it be best to deal out with that now or when you're actually setting it?
Most of these, the pre-selector switching was done by the ground staff when the bomb load was put on the aircraft. All that would be preset for you.
Now, what does it mean? What does a pre-selector? I mean, what did it do?
What a pre-selector did was it selected your load so that once the bomb release was pressed, each of those bomb stations would be released in sequence. Basically to keep the balance of the aircraft, for one thing.
Because you could be carrying a big one. If it went in the wrong order, it could overbalance you slightly.
Well, the point was that invariably you'd feel a certain lift in the aircraft if things were not released in sequence. If one had a jettison, then you'd notice a terrific lift in the aircraft. On the odd occasion when we had to, that was very noticeable.
Now, he'd also tell you the basic wind speed and direction. That was for your Mark X-14 bombsight.
Yes. The Mark 14 was a computerized bombsight. Again, one of the most important factors was the wind speed.
And presumably direction.
Yeah, well, the direction was done automatically, as were the pilot's instruments, of course, so it's governed by that. The one terrific advantage of the Mark 14 bombsight was the graticle, which was illuminated, and in fact, that graticle looked like an inverted Lorraine cross with an illuminated line with a cross at the bottom end. when you are on your bombing run, that line, you could line up first with your markers on the ground, and once you reached the cross section, you released your bombs.
We'll come back to this in the actual bombing run. We'll probably repeat some of that, but that makes it clear. Now, anything else that he'd tell you, that your bomb aimer leader would tell you at the briefing?
Well, basically, of course, your bomb load and the pre-selector settings, which we've just mentioned. Not an awful lot else.
So that would be the end of the briefing, presumably?
That would, yes. And then it was general discussion, basically, with your pilot and the navigator. Those were the three main three.
It says you draw emergency rations and parachutes. Now, what emergency rations, what does it mean by that?
Well, they're a very small pack of emergency rations, which basically included chocolate and emergency rations in case one had to bail out, of course.
Is this your escape kit?
Escape kit, yeah.
So you could call it that. I think that's what we... So there were other things other than food in it?
Yeah.
So what else would be in it?
Water, tablets for water, purification of water, hardtack, of course, compass, small compass, map.
Would that be changed depending on where you were, or was it just a map of Europe?
That's a general map of Europe, yeah. Very basic.
Anything else in there?
Can't think of anything else offhand.
And parachute. Now, where would you get the parachutes from?
You would draw your parachute from the parachute section, together with the harness, of course.
So it wasn't yours, it was just a general issue?
That's right, general issue, yes. You never got the same one. You just draw that as...
Did you have confidence in the parachute packers?
Oh, yes.
That wasn't something that went through your mind?
No, never crossed my mind. We had parachute drill. This was leaping from a bungee jump, as it would be today.
Where from?
From these towers were usually installed in a hangar, and you just leapt from these, as you would, as I say, on a bungee jump.
And what was it like?
Quite an experience. But we only did one or two of those. It was just, again, a basic experience.
Now, so then you'd get it. Would you have a crew meal before you? I mean, not.
Oh, yes.
Before you went?
Yeah, before, yes.
Now, what was the crew meal? I know you had one when you got back. But what was the crew?
It was nearly always egg and bacon.
Before you went, as well as when you got back?
Oh, yes.
What was this thing about egg and bacon that you had? Well, not you, but.
It was a general meal. And of course, it was plentiful. And by the time we got back, we were ready for it. Some of these flights.
But you had the same meal before you went?
Before we went, yeah.
You just liked eggs and bacon?
I liked eggs and bacon, yeah.
And was it more than one egg? I mean, was this a substantial, you know? Cause
there was never a shortage, no. Yeah.
And, so you had your meal, and then what next?
Well, basically, then you would. Once you'd have your meal first, of course, then you'd go down to your briefing.
So the meal was before the briefing, yeah.
Before the briefing, yes. You would never leave the briefing area until you went out to the aircraft.
Now, this is partly the security. How tight was security?
Very, very tight. And, of course, it was a most important factor.
You were aware of the risk, you know.
Oh, yes. One was always impressed on the importance of keeping your lip buttoned.
This was in case the Germans, or spies, or whatever.
This is it. It was amazing what they did know. And in fact, I know of a case where one of our crew was shot down. And when he was being interrogated, of course, they knew the squadron because of the aircraft, the DX, whatever it was. They also knew the air commanding officer, a group captain. They wanted to know how old Taft was. They knew.
N- Now, from there, you got into, well, I presume you had to go out to the aircraft. How did you get to the aircraft?
There were coaches, which of course, well, we call them crew buses in actual fact, and you usually take two or three crews, and you'd be dropped off at your aircraft.
And the aircraft would be dispersed around?
Around the perimeter of the airfield, yes.
And what would you do when you got to your aircraft first?
Well, usually we had a natter with the ground staff.
Now, tell me about the role of the ground staff. I mean, how close were you to them?
Very. We kept our ground crew, and we knew every one of them by Christian name, of course. And also, on occasions, as time permitted, we would take them out to the pub, or meet them in Boston for a drink, and socialise with them. We found that most important.
And were they just doing one aircraft?
Yes. And oh, yes.
Yeah. Were you aware of how much you owed them, in the sense of if they messed up, you could be dead? I mean, was it...
Yeah, one got to rely on them completely. We had our problems, but one could not really associate that or blame the ground crew for any of the things.
So you were satisfied with their work?
Very satisfied. Every confidence.
So you'd have a chat with them? Now,
yes. You were then, before going into the aircraft, I would have a look, see what my bomb load was in position.
So you'd personally check the bomb load?
Bomb load, yes. The bomb doors were still open then.
And would you check the fittings or just look at, just check
just,
them? Just right?
look at them generally. Yeah. And then you'd enter the aircraft and you'd go through your complete procedure of checking that your pre-selector switches were in the correct order. And generally...
And the camera flash.
And the camera flash, yeah.
Now, did you have any superstition? I presume the rest of the crew were doing their similar things.
Exactly. We each had our particular things to do, our equipment to check.
Now, did your crew have any superstitions, or did you have any superstitions? I mean, some crews used to urinate on the back wheel, others wore things or carried things. Did you or your crew have any superstitions?
Yeah, I used to wear an old leather belt, which I do to this day. It's been repaired several times, and I also carried little tiny ornament of a black cat, minus tail. My navigator had a small teddy bear, which always sat ahead of him on his table. I'm not so sure about what the other crew members carried, but invariably everyone had their own little superstition.
And would it worry you if you didn't have it? Seriously worry you, or would it just?
To a point, I think one was always had that superstition. I always wore my belt. That was part and parcel of my dress.